Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to another show of U.S. National Politics Online Blog Talk Radio Show. I'm your host and my co-host is Dr. Jerome Hyler. Today's show, our true founding principles, how limited was limited government meant to be. Good afternoon, Dr. Hyler. How are you today?
Good afternoon. Doing very well. Happy to be with you once again, Chauncey.
It's always a blessing. We're going to jump right in here because I have a lot of questions for you today. Your title says a lot. Dr. Hyler, you are the author of Locke in America, The Moral Philosophy of the Founding Era. Can I assume that your approach to the founding principles has a lot to do with the ideas of John Locke?
You certainly can assume that. While many modern scholars have tried to diminish Locke's influence on the revolutionary era, noting the enormous influence of writers in the tradition of classical republicanism, especially Montesquieu, those scholars were misguided and wrong. The revolutionary thinker Benjamin Rush showed exactly why the influence of the one needn't reflect at all on the influence of the other. Benjamin Rush wrote, quote, "It is one thing to understand the principles and another thing to understand the forms of government. The former are simple, basic principles, why governments are organized. The latter are difficult and complicated. Mr. Locke is an oracle as to the principles of government. Harrington and Montesquieu are oracles as to the forms of government. The founders consulted Montesquieu and other ancient and modern Republican writers in crafting the U.S. Constitution. They relied on Locke's simple and fundamental principles in affixing their signatures to the Declaration of Independence and marching off to war with George Washington. The principles, as developed by Locke, dealt with the most basic questions. For what purpose are governments all formed? From where do they derive their lawful powers? Directly from God or from the people? What exactly are those powers? What must government do for us? And what must we be allowed and expected to do for ourselves and one another? There's nothing wrong with benevolence, generosity, and goodwill toward those who are in need, especially if they are in need through no fault of their own. When must a people say to their government, this far and no farther? Those are the questions Locke addressed.
Dr. Hyler, that's an interesting distinction between the principles and the forms of government. The forms would include a pure democracy, a constitutional republic, a communist or fascist state, or a social democracy like Great Britain, Sweden, Norway, or Denmark. And those are absolutely the really basic questions. How does Locke answer them?
Okay, we'll get to that soon enough, Chauncey. First, we must explore three basic ideas that guided John Locke's thinking. He wants to know how and why governments come into being to begin with. So he posits, one, the state of nature, an original community of families not living under any kind of government at all. It's every man, every family, for himself, for itself. Two, so that's state of nature. Locke offers a natural rights theory. This describes the condition of individuals living in that original state of nature and bound by no political rulers of any kind. No institution possesses a monopoly on the legitimate use of force. That's when governments are formed. And three, to escape the wildly unpleasant state of nature, men enter into a social contract. This creates political institutions with the lawful power to regulate human conduct. In agreeing to the social contract, men solemnly pledge to be bound by the laws their political leaders pass and enforce.
Doctor, so what are the conditions men and families experience in this projected state of nature?
That's the key to understanding everything else. Locke sums it up in two brief but profound observations. First, there is nothing more evident than that creatures of the same species and rank, promiscuously born to all the same advantages of nature, should be equal one amongst another without subjection or subjugation. His second statement, that comes shortly thereafter, quote, "The state of nature, we just talked about, has a law of nature to govern it, and reason, which is that law, teaches all mankind who will but consult it, that being all equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions." Jefferson summed up the point even more simply. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Locke had spoken of life, liberty, and property. It's a distinction without a difference, since happiness depends in part on our freedom to gain, keep, use, trade, or otherwise dispose of our freely acquired possessions. We can't be happy if we don't own any property, if we can't gain it by our own efforts, dispose of it as we please. That is required if anyone is going to be content, secure, safe, and happy. Everyone in 18th century America understood that property is a part of being happy. Go ahead.
I apologize. I got excited by asking or getting ready to ask you the next question while I was thinking about that. Locke was one of my favorite philosophers, as long as with Kant when I was in college. Professor, could you explain exactly what those rights are that Locke is speaking about?
Sure. What is the condition of men living in a state of nature? Locke just told us. Being all equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. It is the American creed, live and let live. That's pure Lockeanism. Now, Locke needed a concrete concept that could codify and concretize this important principle of live and let live. What he needed was the idea of a right, a natural right. Ayn Rand, who followed Locke and went even further, defined a right as, quote, "a moral concept defining and sanctioning freedom of action in a social context." Let me repeat. "A moral concept defining and sanctioning freedom of action in a social context. Now we can say what they are. First, they are natural. They are given to us at birth by our nature. We are endowed with those rights. No one has to wait for a monarch or president or Congress to confer them. That is key. That means they are natural. The right to life is simply the right to live one's life as one pleases, but not interfere with everyone else's equal right to do as much. In the state of nature, we are all born with certain needs and certain capacities to fulfill those needs, and we must be allowed the freedom to exercise our capacities to satisfy our needs. To live one's life is to be free to say and do what one pleases. That is, to exercise liberty. In exercising liberty, one naturally acquires property, the just fruits of honest industry, as our founders would say. What one produces or acquires through acts of voluntary exchange, free market trade, is one's own to dispose of as one pleases. Now, it would be nice if every man actually respected his neighbor's life, liberty, and property. But that is not the condition in which human beings find themselves. The state of nature is necessarily precarious because not all will respect the rights of others. There will always be scoundrels, thugs, to prey on their weaker or helpless neighbors. In fact, two very decent neighbors may dispute a debt alleged to be owed. If a weak tree in my yard is stricken by lightning and collapses on my neighbor's barn, he may well knock on my door in the morning demanding restitution. I may feel his pain, but deciding it was, quote, an act of God, unquote, not anyone's responsibility, not my responsibility, I might give him some sympathy, but nothing else. There is no judicial authority in a state of nature to adjudicate the competing claims or executive to enforce the court's rulings. There are no courts. It could still come to blows, recriminations, and open feuding. So the state of nature is a precarious state. It is not a secure state.
Okay, doctor, so that's not a very safe or secure way to live. How can society struggle in the state of nature, protect itself from bullies, thugs, meandering hordes, violent gangs, or conquering armies?
What is needed is a sovereign power to establish rules of justice that, insofar as possible, will assure that everyone's rights are protected. From where comes its legitimacy, its lawful power, its authority? Locke's answer is from the people themselves. Now, there is a fourth natural right. So far, we talked about life, liberty, and property in Locke's context, but he identifies a fourth natural right that everyone also possesses. Men not only have the right to live their lives, they have a right to protect their lives, their liberties, and possessions from any who would come along to violate them. No one can claim a right to violate another's rights. That's the definition of a wrong. Since every individual has a right to defend what is his with force if necessary, he can choose to delegate that right to agencies of government that are established to offer exactly such protection. So men agree not to become vigilantes, not to take the law into their own hands, but to rely on an objective rule of law to adjudicate all claims, right all wrongs, in short, see that justice is done.
Okay, doctor, you've taken us pretty far in understanding our founding principles. You showed us that power comes from the people, that people possess certain natural rights, life, liberty, property, and the right to freely pursue their happiness, but through the voluntary acts of trade with others, not by denying them their inalienable rights. You've explained that people naturally have a right to protect and defend what is theirs from those who would violate their rights, and that to better secure their rights, they form governments and delegate this right to self-defense to legislatures and enforcement agencies to live safely and prosper. Now, just have to say, as you said you would, how limited is limited government was meant to be?
Okay, that's the next step. So if all men are equal and equally endowed with the liberty to, among other things, gain, keep, use, trade, or otherwise dispose of their possessions, the possessions that they themselves produce or acquire by engaging not in theft or fraud, but voluntary trade with others. And government's job is to protect every individual in the enjoyment of what is his, then government may not benefit any individual, family, class, or collection of special interests at anyone else's expense. Needless to say, this abiding moral principle was egregiously violated in many instances when it came to the treatment of African slaves, Native American tribes, and women generally. Civil rights and women's rights battles needed to be waged and were eventually won to this country's credit. And it is worth noting that it was those very founding principles that were the weapons used by Martin Luther King and other champions of liberty to win those precious rights. Properly understood and fully implemented, government, the protector, may not transform itself into a provider. For when Congress, the courts, or some executive agency confer special benefits on some, ultimately at some other's expense, it denies equal protection under law to all. And as government was meant to be a protector in all things, so it cannot become a provider. And this principle is absolute, precisely because, as Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, quote, "To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed," unquote. Since no one has a right or lawful power to take away or give away what belongs to another, that is a power no one can give to government. And so a power government can neither claim nor come by. No one ever put it better than John Locke in his Second Treatise of Government. He writes, quote, "For nobody can transfer to another more power than he has in himself, and nobody has an absolute arbitrary power over any other to take away the life or property of another. And having in the state of nature no arbitrary power over the life, liberty, or possessions of another, but only so much as the law of nature gives him to the preservation of himself, this is all he doth or can give up to the commonwealth, so that legislative can have no more than this. The legislative bodies can have no more than this. The power to pick winners and losers, as we say today, to have some live at others' expense, is a power governments may not perform. Since it is a power, the individuals who agree to live under government themselves do not possess. Government in the United States, in short, was designed to be a protector, not a provider. In fact, these founding principles did African slaves, native tribes, and women generally no good for the longest time. So they were just as violated when it came to the country's white population. They were just as violated in many ways. The second bill signed into law by our first president, for example, the Tariff Act of 1789, which we've spoken of in earlier shows, already embodied a scheme to pick winners and losers. It benefited domestic manufacturers at the expense of Western farmers, Southern planters, shipbuilders, seaport merchants, and thousands no longer employed in the once brisk transatlantic trade. So-called protective tariffs protected domestic manufacturers from free international competition and allowed them to raise their prices and reap richer profits. But that meant a higher cost of living for consumers. Farmers and planters now have to sell their produce in politically unprotected markets, but buy tools, utensils, weapons, textiles, etc., in politically protected markets at artificially higher prices. In fact, since foreign producers sold less of their goods in American markets because of the tariff, they lost the wherewithal to buy American produce from the very farmers and planters who were already so disadvantaged by the Tariff Act. And that was just the start of the favorable treatment showered on some Americans by government at the expense of other Americans. Today we call it the swamp, the establishment, but it's the same process of winners benefiting at the expense of losers at the behest of American government. How did the nation get from that early day, Tariff Act of 1789, to this day? Here's the principle. Once a nation decides that some of its citizens have a right not to go out and get, but to lobby Congress and be given, it must face two unavoidable questions. Well, who else should be given? and how much should everybody get? Unfortunately, there's only one answer: politics. Hence, the filling of the Washington swamp and emergence of what President Trump appropriately calls the corrupt establishment.
For those who are listening and joining us right now, you are listening to a U.S. National Politics Online. Today's show, Our True Founding Principles, How Limited Was Limited Government Meant to Be? We are listening to Dr. Jerome Hyler, my co-host. I'm Chauncey Brown. As we continue, Doctor, your conclusion seems to be logically inescapable from your premise. Government gets its power from the people. The people have no power to take away or give away what belongs to others, so they cannot give such a power to government. But let me ask you this. Can you give us concrete evidence to show that the founders, in fact, rejected the idea of government using power to benefit some by harming others?
And how? In fact, this is not well known enough. The whole reason the founders reassembled in Philadelphia in 1787 to draft a new constitution for the country was the complete violation of men's indispensable natural rights by many of the state governments. And let me go into some detail about that. It really is instructive. Given the hard times many Americans faced in the wake of the War of Independence, many farmers were hard-pressed and in debt. Many faced foreclosure of their lands to their creditors who held their debts, their mortgages. The farmers then ran to their state houses to press for what was called mortgage stay laws that legally barred foreclosure. They also pleaded with legislative bodies for paper emissions. These were easy money policies that would devalue the currency and allow them to repay their debts with money worth a fraction of what it was worth when they made their loans. In other words, legislators would simply emit new reams of paper money, and the indebted farmers would use the new money, the new paper emissions, to pay their loans, even though as more money circulated through the economy, the value of every dollar was worth less. So those who held mortgages were being paid in pennies for what was worth dollars when they themselves made the loans. Some were benefited. Some benefited by the practice of paper emissions and mortgage stay laws. Many suffered. When creditors demanded specie, not depreciated paper, they said, pay me in gold, that's all I will accept in payment of debts. They were hit with another legislative gambit, legal tender acts. That meant government could force them to accept the effective loss of value for the loans they expected to be honest, they expected would be honorably discharged. In other words, now a farmer in debt gave paper money to the bank who gave him his mortgage, and the bank could no longer reject or deny the paper money because it was against the law to reject it. They were forced to accept money worth pennies on the dollar of the original loans they made. Americans who knew right from wrong spoke their minds in no uncertain moral terms. Noah Webster, for example, wrote this, quote, so many legal infractions of sacred right, so many public invasions of private property, so many wanton abuses of legislative powers. Summing up the situation, another staunch defender of property and contract stormed, believe this was Amos Singletary, quote, my countrymen, the devil is among you. Make paper as much as you please. Make it a tender in all future contracts, or let it rest on its own credit. But remember that past contracts are sacred things, and that legislatures have no right to interfere with them. They have no right to say, a debt shall be paid at a discount or in any manner which the parties never intended. To pay bona fide contracts for cash in paper of little value or in old horses would be a dishonest attempt in an individual. But for legislatures to frame laws to support and encourage such detestable villainy is like a judge who should inscribe the arms of a rogue over the seat of justice.
Now I can say, wow, that's all this host needs to hear. A very strong case. So at the end of the day, the founding principles make government a protector, but bar it from becoming a provider. And today, where do things stand, Dr. Heiler?
Sadly, taking all the social welfare entitlements and crony capitalist corporate welfare arrangements together, Washington spends 80 cents of every dollar each year on the entire universe of transfer payments. Insofar as government is serving the people as a protector, supporting national defense and law enforcement and justice, the federal government today is merely moonlighting. So the entire corporate welfare, social welfare state is a state never envisioned by our founders, never desired by our founders, in fact regarded as woefully illegitimate and irresponsible by our founding fathers, and yet that is the state in which we find ourselves today. 80 cents of every $1. Now, what this means is that if government was not the social corporate welfare state it turned into, every American in this country would be able to keep 80 cents of every dollar he or she is paying in taxes every year. That money would stay in his or her own wallet, pocketbook, to spend as he or she pleases. Right now it is being taken, 80 cents of every dollar government spends, not to defend their rights, their liberties, their possessions, but to take their possessions because someone else, Congress decides, or an executive agency decides, or the courts decide, somebody else needs that money more or is more deserving of it. And of course, all of that leads to is nothing but corruption of the entire political system, as every special interest under the sun works its way through the halls of government in order to grab some of the loot. And that's where we stand today.
Dr. Heiler, I want to thank you very, very much for joining us and bringing our audience closer to the understanding of our true founding principles, how limited government was meant to be. For our audience, please join Dr. Heiler and myself next Tuesday, June 11th at 4 o'clock to hear about the natural rights and human nature. Once again, we want to thank everybody.
Yeah, in other words, Chauncey, let me interrupt just to say that what we're going
to
talk about.
You have 60 seconds.
Go ahead. Okay, just to say that next week what we're going to do is establish exactly rational proofs why we do come into the world with these natural rights. They really are ours. We are born with two arms, two legs, two eyes, and the freedom to walk the path we choose in life and not be sacrificed for the sake of others who are more politically connected. That is next week.
Thank you very much, Dr. Heiler. We want to thank all our listeners once again for joining us. Please join us next Tuesday for another episode of U.S. National Politics Online at 4 o'clock. Thank you very much for listening. God bless America.
Thank you, Chauncey. Thank you, listeners.
You're welcome.